Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the Senate Judiciary Committee hears Dr. Christine Blasey Ford's testimony alleging sexual misconduct by Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. We hear local lawmakers' reactions. Meanwhile, the House holds hearings on allegations of sexual misconduct by former North Carolina Congressman, now director of the Federal Housing Finance Agency, Mel Watt. City Council considers moving from 2 to 4 year terms. The city considers selling land to use for affordable housing. A scooter accident raises questions about the need for regulation and some movement on the Eastland Mall site. Plus, we get an update on ongoing flooding damage and recovery from Hurricane Florence. Our roundtable of reporters is ready to detail those stories and others, and those reporters include our own Alex Olgan from WFAE News. Good morning. Eric Spanberg is your senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Kirsten Garris is a government reporter for Spectrum News. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Glenn Birkins joins us. He's editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. We're all on the radio. You can also watch us on Facebook Live. So before we get to the news that transfixed everyone around the nation on airplanes, in bars, in everywhere, let's talk about something that was tragically sad in the news yesterday here. Yesterday, search personnel found a body in their search for 6-year-old Maddox Rich, the autistic Gaston County boy, a boy who disappeared last weekend. And according to the boy's father, he went missing at Rankin Lake Park on Saturday. The body was found literally across the street from the park in water. The FBI, 24 other agencies, about 330 people were looking for this child. Do we know if it's turned out to be the body of that young boy?
We're still waiting to hear from Gaston County Police and the FBI to confirm that, but they say it's very reasonable that it is likely the body of Maddox Rich, which is hard news to take for a lot of folks, because literally since Saturday, this entire community and even across the state, people have been coming to search for this little boy because he's not only autistic but nonverbal. So a very challenging task already, but with those other things added on it. But you really saw the FBI so many resources were used. They used different techniques that we may not see often. I mean, they recorded Maddox's parents' voice to hopefully see if that would help, because, again, since he's nonverbal, maybe hearing his parents' voice would help him, you know, come from the woods. They had search teams going into manholes, into drains. I mean, they had specialized dogs. I mean, they had a really tactical – this was a very big tactical mission to try and find little Maddox, and obviously this was not the outcome a lot of people were hoping for.
We always do in these situations, we hear from the parents who want their child back, obviously, and they're on television. What have we heard from them in the aftermath of this announcement that they found a body?
I know on Facebook, his father, Ian, mentioned how he'll live with this moment for the rest of his life. And this is tough. I mean, this is, you hate that cliche, this is every parent's worst nightmare, but this is a tough moment to swallow that these two parents have lost their child. And there's still a lot of questions. That's the thing, though. The FBI says this investigation is not over. It's almost in a way just beginning, because there are questions about what were his last movements. How did he get a mile away from the park? And it's worth noting that search teams had already searched that area several times before yesterday. He was so covered up in debris and, you know, bushes, that's how covered up he was. It was almost camouflage, so it was impressive. Police said that they even found his body where they did.
Do we know if it was natural camouflage or if somebody tried to camouflage?
I don't think we know yet. The medical examiner's report should give us some information about how he died. Obviously, it won't give us a suspect, but it'll be important to know if he drowned or exactly what caused him to die. I was in Gaston County on a different story yesterday, but everyone was sort of on edge. I was there around 1 o'clock, and people were saying, "Did you hear what happened? They found him." And it's you could tell people were just waiting.
Well, no matter, they don't have any suspects that they've talked about yet. Is that right?
That they haven't told us. Now, I mean, the police have not told us a lot of things, and that's fair. This is an ongoing investigation. But there have been a lot of community support. Gaston itself is a smaller town outside of Charlotte, and they have come together almost every night. There have been vigils, there have been prayers, there have been people coming together, whether they knew Maddox or not, hoping for his safe return. So you see that community has really rallied around this family, and so it's likely they'll do the same in the days moving forward.
And they have talked about people who might be potential witnesses, who they would like to come forward
to. There's a guy in a white truck they're looking for.
A white truck. I think there's a jogger.
That's right. Photographer. So that's the thing. They're still looking for witnesses even after finding Maddox. So it shows that the investigation, again, is still not over. So they still have that special tip line. So if you know anything, they're like, hey, we still need to talk to you to figure out what may have happened.
Presumably finding Maddox. We don't know yet for sure that that's
correct. It is very reasonable that.
Exactly. Well, we'll keep our eyes on that for the next several months, I'm sure. Yesterday, of course, Dr. Christine Blasey Ford gave her testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee about her allegations of sexual misconduct by Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. The questions from Republicans came from an experienced prosecutor from Maricopa County, Arizona. What's the verdict on how she comported herself?
Well, it was really hard for her to get a successive line of questioning because she only had 5 minutes. I mean, everyone only had 5 minutes, and so I think...
Was the process designed to be revelatory, or was it designed to fail?
It doesn't strike me that it was designed to be particularly revelatory.
It was, you're right, it was very stilted, many people have commented on how when you have a prosecutor who obviously is used to building momentum through a series of questions, extended momentum, you need time to do that. And every time she would get a couple questions in, then it was time to go to a Democrat. And I'm sure we'll get to this as this conversation goes on. One of the notable things about this prosecutor, of course, is that she did go through the entire questioning process with Dr. Ford, and then they abruptly switched gears when they got to Judge Kavanaugh.
But the you asked, was it designed to be revelatory? Absolutely not. One of the most striking things to me is that only two witnesses were called. No, right. there were lots of people at this party, including Kavanaugh's friend, who was said to be in the room when this
Mark Judge
allegation or alleged attack happened. How could you not call a person who the accuser says was in the room and actually witnessed it? How could you not put that person under oath and say, is this true?
Do you think that's what most of America is asking this morning, or is most of America on Kavanaugh's side?
I think that what this showed is that America is just so divided, so starkly divided. It struck me, for example, let's just take Kavanaugh for a moment. I think you could describe him as angry, defiant, and partisan. And then you could go to the two camps and they would say, absolutely, for entirely different reasons. You know, on the left, they would say it was completely inappropriate. You know, it was obfuscatory story. I can't even say it. He was obfuscating, I should say. And then on the right, they would say, well, yes, he's been smeared. He's been treated unfairly. Of course, he is defiant. And I think that is just one example of what the whole day was like.
You can be defiant, I would think, particularly if you are innocent of the charges. I could understand completely why he would be angry, why he would be defiant, even why he would be belligerent to a certain degree. But he was, as you said, pretty partisan. He firmly blamed the Democrats for setting the country up for what he called a whirlwind that the country would experience for years to come. He echoed concerns from those on both sides of the aisle who fear for the future of our democracy because of the current political environment. He did not blame Dr. Ford, very cleverly, I thought. He did lay blame at the feet of the media for breathlessly reporting the allegations and a highly orchestrated, solidly financed effort to trash his name and reputation and end his nomination by Democrats who he said were lying in wait and unable to take him out on the merits. Are these words we're supposed to hear from somebody who may sit on the Supreme Court and have to be deciding cases on the left and right?
I think he has one very clear, very important audience member, and that is the president. And my perception is that that's exactly what the president wanted to hear, that kind of tone, that kind of language, that kind of sort of punching back.
And that's what the president said. He tweeted out, this is why I nominated Brett Kavanaugh for this seat. So, I mean, he approved, so to speak, in his tweet with Kavanaugh's testimony yesterday.
But
so
beyond the actual
–
go ahead.
Point, Mike, more to your point – I would say no, you don't want that. I understand him being angry. I don't understand him being belligerent. Even if you're being falsely accused, you have to remember who you are. You have to remember what office you're being nominated for, and you have to comport yourself properly. That performance yesterday will forever taint his tenure on the
court.
Well,
nobody is comporting themselves properly anymore. And when you look at his behavior yesterday, when you look at the behavior of the people running that committee hearing who refused to hear from other witnesses who don't want the FBI involved, who would not even hold hearings on Merrick Garland, who now blame the Democrats for being obstructionists when they were, in fact, obstructionists. Is this the beginning of the end? I'm not kidding. I'm serious about this. Is this the beginning of the end? You cannot govern this country this way.
Well, I think one thing that strikes me going back to this issue of comportment. Remember, he's a sitting judge right now. That is one thing that kept sort of resonating with me. And I really would like to know, and I'm sure we never will, Chief Justice Roberts is very much a traditionalist in terms of the decorum of the court. And that was not a traditional approach, no matter how you feel about Judge Kavanaugh.
We have to take a break. We'll come back and we'll hear some local reaction to this, particularly from Senator Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, who was the, I don't want to say star of the day, but he took the focus. I think it was Ford, Kavanaugh, and Graham. We'll get to that in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the weekly news roundup. Alex Olgan is here from WFAE News, Kirsten Garris from Spectrum News, Glenn Birkins, editor-publisher, QCityMetro.com, and Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal. So let's talk about Lindsey Graham, because he was the third star of the day yesterday. He certainly took the focus a lot. On Sunday, with Chris Wallace on Fox News, he seemed to be saying that his mind was made up no matter what Dr. Ford's testimony was going to be. And yesterday, during a recess, he essentially told reporters that he didn't believe her because she couldn't remember the exact date and time of the attack. I'm going to go through this sequentially because his take on this built through the day. So that was in one of the early breaks. He said that she didn't believe her because she couldn't remember the exact date and time of the attack. And then he complained about how these accusations have not been verifiable and that this should not become the new standard for vetting nominees, warning Democrats that if it were the new standard, just watch what will happen to their nominees. And he also complained about the timing of these allegations coming to the committee so close to a vote and so close to the midterms.
All I can say is that we're 40-something days away from the election, and their goal, not Ms. Ford's goal, is to delay this past the midterms so they can win the Senate and never allow Trump to fill the seat. I believe that now more than ever. I don't know who paid for a polygraph, but somebody did, and here's what I'm more convinced of. The friends on the other side set it up to be just the way it is.
That doesn't explain why the committee can't pause. Why can't they pause? What is the rush?
Well, he just explained why they can't pause, because of the midterms. It would be almost impossible to get another nominee vetted. But wait,
they paused for a year on the other nomination of President Obama because of the upcoming election. Why not wait for the midterms to see what the country thinks?
Well, Senator McConnell has said the difference is that if it's a presidential year versus a midterm year.
You can dish it out, but you can't take it.
Okay. He also said that Dr. Ford's trust had been betrayed by those who leaked this letter that came to the attention of the media, and that she was as much a victim as Kavanaugh was. He called her a nice lady, and he said that nothing she said would hold up in a court of law.
A nice lady who has come forward to tell a hard story that's uncorroborated, and this is enough. God help anybody else that gets nominated. Based on what I heard today, you could not get a search warrant or an arrest warrant because you don't know the location, you don't know the time, and you don't have any corroboration.
It seemed, when you were watching that on television, and I was, as everybody else was, it seemed as he was building towards something with these hallway conversations with reporters. And in fact, it turned out that he was, because at one point yesterday, he became apoplectic, Senator Graham. He was seething with anger at Democrats. This is a very long clip, but I want to play all of it so you can get the full impact.
If you wanted an FBI investigation, you could have come to us.
What you want to do is destroy this guy's life, hold this seat open, and hope you win in 2020. You've said that, not me. You've got nothing to apologize for. When you see Sotomayor and Kagan, tell them that Lindsey said hello, because I voted for them. I would never do to them what you've done to this guy. This is the most unethical sham since I've been in politics. And if you really wanted to know the truth, you sure as hell wouldn't have done what you've done to this guy. Are you a gang rapist?
No.
I cannot imagine what you and your family have gone through. Boy, y'all want power. God, I hope you never get it. I hope the American people can see through this sham, that you knew about it and you held it. You had no intention of protecting Dr. Ford. None. She's as much of a victim as you are. God, I hate to say it, because these have been my friends. But let me tell you, when it comes to this, you're looking for a fair process. You came to the wrong town at the wrong time, my friend.
I've never seen anything like that before. Comments?
I think, and this is pure speculation, but as I was saying during the break, I think his poll numbers in South Carolina must be really bad, because just a few months ago, he was what was masquerading as a moderate in the Republican Party. He was actually, he and John McCain were actually what would be considered today moderates. And whether it's been his position on the Mueller investigation or Trump's right to fire Mueller, or this, Lindsey Graham has just done a, what is it, 160?
180.
180.
Well, I was never good at that.
Could have been a 362.
That's close enough.
Yeah, close enough. Well, he's turned a lot. And so, you know, it's hard to explain what has happened to Lindsey Graham. But the Lindsey Graham we knew just 3 or 4 months ago is no more.
But he was really emotional. He almost couldn't get it out, some of that. I'm just wondering where that's coming from. Is he alone, or is he just the spokesperson for what all of the people in Congress who are not Democrats are feeling about this process?
Well, one of the things that struck me about Senator Graham is, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure I'm correct, he was the first Republican to speak, to sort of take the mic from the prosecutor yesterday, I think. And even if he wasn't, he certainly was the most forceful. And I just wondered if some of that frustration was that, for whatever reason, they didn't like the direction of the way the Kavanaugh inquiry was going. And so he decided, look, I'm going to put this back on the course that I think it should be on, because
he's a prosecutor.
Yes.
Wasn't he a judge?
Yeah, I know he was a prosecutor.
Okay.
And he certainly is familiar with the law, and he is certainly familiar with politics, as Glenn said. And it certainly changed the tenor of the rest of that discussion with Judge Kavanaugh. So if that was his intent, he achieved it.
Judge Kavanaugh kept being asked by the Democrats yesterday, would you be willing to ask the president to have the FBI investigate this? And he said he kept obfuscating the answer. And he did point out that he had been investigated by the FBI on several occasions, because he's already a federal judge and they investigate you for that. But Dr. Michael Bitzer, who is the head of the Department of Politics at Catawba College, told me yesterday that when FBI do investigations on people running for federal office, those investigations begin at the age of 18. These sexual improprieties are alleged to have occurred at the age of 17, so the FBI may not have uncovered this.
But exactly. The FBI can only investigate what is known. This was unknown when he was appointed to other judgeships. So, of course, they weren't able to investigate.
Well, the other thing that was interesting, Mike, that I think it was the second clip you played where Senator Graham was saying this would never hold up in a court of law, this would never be viewed as corroborating evidence, so on and so forth. Remember, let's come back to, this is not a trial, a criminal proceeding. This is a job interview, as everyone keeps calling it. This is to decide whether Brett Kavanaugh is worthy of being on the Supreme Court. So I think those things are getting intermingled, and they shouldn't. This is about whether he goes on the Supreme Court not a criminal trial.
So but it's also a job interview in the era of now the Me Too movement, right, where more women are speaking up about past sexual assault accusations, but still moments that happened that they didn't feel comfortable or felt like they couldn't share before. So I think there is a different tone on Capitol Hill because now we are in the era of several people from every industry have literally been taken from their either high position and now they've been fired or terminated or something because of accusations that ended up being true. So I think there is a different mood on Capitol Hill because everyone is seeing that and you're seeing more protesters. I mean, this is a different mood.
Let me be clear. I wasn't saying that the topic should not be discussed. What I'm saying is that what he's looking for is not what
true.
Is at
right.
issue here. At issue here is whether what happened is indicative of his character and should therefore disqualify him from the Supreme Court. It's not whether he could be convicted in a court.
So Lindsey Graham also pointed out or warned Republicans that a no vote was a vote for essentially destroying the process going forward. So it's 9:30. They're voting this morning at 9:30. And we've just been told that Senator Jeff Flake, one of the three senators on whom this hinges, Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski being the other two, he has just said he is voting for Kavanaugh. So now it hinges on the two women. We'll see what happens. Yesterday, there was also another hearing on the other side of the Capitol in the House, another sexual misconduct hearing, this time involving former North Carolina Congressman Mel Watt, now director of the Federal Housing Finance Agency. This was his first appearance since allegations against him became public. Given how deeply overshadowed this hearing was by the other, what do we know about what happened? We know that he denied the allegations. Is that right?
Yes, he absolutely denied it. He said, I believe this was a budget committee hearing. He said that that his accuser essentially leaked selected parts of the tape, and that the part she leaked did not paint the entire picture. He said he was trying to mentor her. One of the things that I found really interesting is that there are several investigations going on right now. I think the Postal Service is investigating. Two other government, Inspector General's office is investigating, and at least one other federal agency is investigating. Mr. Watt has not cooperated with those investigations. He says his attorney told him that as a presidential appointee, he did not have to investigate. He did not have to cooperate.
And yeah, because those kinds of investigations, he said, were for rank and file employees.
Exactly.
Could he be right about that?
Well, I don't know if he's right. I'm not an attorney, but it's not a good look. And I think one of the Republicans on the committee pointed that out. Why would he hold himself to a standard that is lower than the standard that he would expect from his employees?
Alex.
That's not a good sign. And, you know, even what strikes me as bizarre is even if he was mentoring her, I mean, I've had mentors and I've never had them talk about their attraction to me or my beauty. I mean, that even if it's a selective portion of the tape, why is a mentor telling a mentee about how beautiful they are?
And it could certainly make that person very uncomfortable because it's a power differential. But there is no accusation here, is there, of any kind of sexual attack or forcing himself on her, is there in these allegations?
Not that I'm
aware of. I don't believe there are any.
Okay. So I guess we'll what happens next? What happens next? Anybody know?
I don't know.
Okay.
Well, his time is running up. He's only in office
until
January, so who knows how this is going to play out.
So this week, Charlotte City Council began talking about switching from two-year terms to four-year terms. I don't think that this is the first time this conversation has come up.
You are correct, Mike. You are correct.
I've heard this before.
And why has it come up this time?
We said, I think, last year that this is a new crop of city council. I mean, this city council, I mean, they're tackling the things that we haven't talked about before. But interesting enough, a lot of the veterans support this idea of extending term limits because they talk about it each year. They get one good year of, like, working,
right,
and then, like, they look up the second year, and they're already on the campaign trail. It's just a very quick turnaround.
It's the same schedule that all the Congress people
are
on.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, that's what they say. And they,
well, actually, I'm not sure that's wrong. I'm thinking that in today's world that maybe we need to have longer term limits because you get into the job, longer terms, because you get into the job and you just learn where the bathroom is and you have to run for office.
And that's basically what they're saying is that, I mean, especially with this, I mean, you have six new members under the age of 40, but just six new members in general who are first-time politicians, and they literally just figured out how to pass a budget, how to do this, and next, you know, March, they're going to have to file for office if they want to continue having that seat.
I do think it's interesting, though, that our view of politics has sunk to the level that we all just take it for granted. And in fact, the politicians just say out front that, of course, we're not going to take any difficult issues on when it's election year because we got a campaign. I mean, that's just a given. You know, that year's burned.
So nothing gets done except for one year every 2 years every four, half the time. The most senior member of City Council, James Mitchell, supports this move, and so does Councilman Greg Phipps.
You know, I just don't think that the two-year term affords enough time, especially for new council members coming in, to be able to engage and get to know what's going on and then have to, you know, run again, you know, just a few months after that.
Which is just what you said. So how many council people are in favor of the four-year terms? How many are not? Do we know?
Basically, all the Democrats are receptive to it. It's the two Republicans who are definitely not at this moment interested.
Tarek doesn't want the spotlight to continue?
Well, he's got conditions. He's
exactly.
Willing to talk. He's willing to negotiate, I think, is basically a good way to put it.
So when and how would this decision be made? And why didn't it happen before? Is whatever happened before likely to happen again?
Well, those are a lot of questions, but the basic answer is that council makes the decision. They have the power to decide. They have not figured out when they want to take a vote on this.
They have the power to decide unless overruled by the legislature.
Yes. This is true, but this is one of the few things they could just change on their own, which is huge because we are a Dillon Rule state, so that is something that is impressive.
And it has been suggested that these would be staggered four-year terms with the mayor and at-large members running in one-year cycle and then the district members running in the second-year cycle of all this. We have to take a break. We'll talk about something else the city is up to, and that is possibly selling land for affordable housing. News on the Eastland Mall front and more on the crime stats from CMPD. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. On the next Charlotte Talks, guest host Eric Spanberg takes a look at causes and consequences of tension in the Middle East with Ryan Crocker, a man who has been U.S. ambassador to several countries in that part of the world, including Iraq and Afghanistan, when Charlotte Talks, Monday at 9 on WFAE and WFAE.org. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup with Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer from the Charlotte Business Journal, Glenn Perkins, editor-publisher of QCityMetro.com, Kirsten Garris, government reporter from Spectrum News, and our own Alex Olgan from WFAE's newsroom. The mayor, of course, we've talked about this many times, has advocated for more affordable housing. There's a bond on the ballot this November for $50 million to help toward that end. And this week, City Housing Director Pamela Weidman told council members one option to achieve their goal would be to sell city-owned property and earmark it for affordable housing. Is this a new idea?
Well, the way they're doing it, it's not just affordable housing, but affordable home ownership. So a different term here because they want to help people. That's a one way. Having a house is one way to build wealth, but also just a way to build equity. So that's what they're trying to do is have city land that is already owned by them, sell it to groups like Habitat for Humanity or other organizations that work with low-income families and build them houses that they can afford to buy. And they also want to add a 15-year deed restriction so it stays affordable for 15 years, regardless of who lives there. So if I live in a house for 5 years, they're going to sell it to someone else who can also qualify for that same kind of program, so it stays affordable for that time.
Because this is more than just about affordable housing, as Pamela Weidman pointed out. She said what you're getting in exchange for selling city property and maybe donating some city property is the opportunity for, quote, someone to live in an area of high opportunity, gain wealth, and achieve economic mobility. This is what this is about because of that economic mobility study that put us at the bottom of the heap. This will come up for a vote on October the 8th. What's the likely outcome?
I think people are pretty receptive to it. I mean, it's a new way of – I think everyone said there's no one way to solve this problem.
I think what's interesting and you know, plenty of plans and programs end up on shelves, but it is interesting that – really, since the Scott shooting, which we talked about, I guess it was last week or the week before, and how that changed the direction of the discussion politically and in corporate circles has all gone to this mobility study.
Right.
And whether it's shame or whatever the reason is, people are definitely starting to focus on this affordable housing in multiple ways, because you saw the corporate donations in the past couple of months with not only land but money. Now, as with everything, you have to be rigorous about this to see if it truly succeeds. But I do think there is at least a shift in tone in regards to this issue.
Exactly. And changing the conversation that it isn't, there's no one, this is not right. one size fits all. There isn't. But I think to change the conversation to home ownership, that was key that Pamela Wideman has talked about, is like, this is not just getting people into affordable apartments. This is helping people get a real home for the first time, maybe.
And one of the things that the mayor and all of the new city councilmen, council people ran on was, the time for talk is over, the time for action is now, and this is action.
This is action. And the other thing that stands out to me, and again, I mean, this is just a small example, so I don't know if it will be catching, so to speak. But traditionally what's happened in Charlotte is that all of the affordable housing has been shoved into, you know, areas that are not affluent, that don't offer as much opportunity. And that's been a huge complaint and frustration for lower income people. And I think this is perhaps a ray of hope and momentum for people who want to see that change.
Well, we're going to switch topics slightly here. And it's ironic that as we do, a parade of people on Segways have just gone past us.
A great segue for this conversation.
Oh, that's great.
I'll see myself out. Sorry.
I didn't know if I'd gotten something wrong. Everybody started laughing.
Point is that they weren't on scooters. And City Councilman Tariq Bakari witnessed a scooter accident this week. The woman riding the scooter allegedly ran a red light at 4th and Brevard, collided with another vehicle, and Bakari characterized what he saw as horrific.
This is the exact kind of thing that we're worried about, because we're trying to figure out how to regulate these things right now. And how do you regulate against someone doing it? I mean, you can't. That was just pure stupidity. Thank God she's okay.
What were her injuries? Do we know?
I don't know. I know they were non-life-threatening.
I think it was her legs. I don't know exactly what the injuries were, but I think her legs were...
She is expected to be okay, which is good, because unfortunately someone has died from these. Not here, but I think Larkin Eccleston said in Texas.
In the Dallas area. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he has also said that somebody will die here before the year is out. This has initiated discussion about the need for more, or I guess given life to discussion, because it's already been initiated, to the need for more regulation on these. Not every city council member is on board with more regulation, though. Who is? Who isn't?
Well, obviously, I know Tariq Bakari is very interested in regulating. Larkin Eggleston is trying to figure out how do you regulate. But Braxton Winston said he's not ready to regulate quite yet, because we're in the weird boat of the market is growing very quickly. But at the same time, you got to figure out, well, how do we keep people safe? And that's what they're trying to balance.
One thing I really don't understand is, what is the difference between a bicyclist and a scooter rider? I mean, to me, it feels like they should be controlled in the same way,
shape, or form. Well, I think the motorized aspect changes it. There was that blog with the UNC School of Government about how scooters just kind of fall into a no man's land, in essence.
But I think going to her point, and I agree with that, I think there is some level of hysteria around scooters, because they're new and they seem to be everywhere. But it's like we're almost waiting for something really bad to happen to say, see there, I told you. But bad things happen to bicycle riders
all the time.
Too.
Well, this woman allegedly ran a red light. People in automobiles run red lights all the time. So is there a difference?
Well, one question I would ask, and I don't know the answer to this, could she be ticketed for that? Could she? Whereas a licensed driver, you know, your insurance rate goes up, the police handle it, and those kinds of things. I don't know what you do with a scooter rider.
Even the terminology is, you know, I think he said she ran a red light. Someone just yesterday did the same to me on a scooter, and I thought of it more as crossing against the light, which gives it a little softer edge than running a red light. What are the rules for these things?
In some cities, bicyclists can get tickets for, you know, having their bike on the sidewalk or certain things. And I just wonder, you know, is that maybe a reasonable way to consider this?
And everybody keeps talking about the need for helmets, but that's never going to happen, because even if they put a helmet on the scooter that you rented, I'm not putting that thing on my head. So you'd have to carry your own helmet.
Did Mike just do a reverse public service message?
So you reported this week. We're going to move on now. We're going to scoot out of here.
Scoot to the next topic.
You reported this week, Eric, that the next step in the redevelopment of the old Eastland Mall site took place this week. You say City Council voted unanimously to have the city government staffers begin formal talks with the Crosland-led development team. I thought council had already decided on Crosland and that the talks had already begun.
I was going to say, they need a scooter to get this issue moving because this one has been stuck in neutral forever. I'll try not to use any more analogies involving transportation. They are finally going to have the – what they did was they authorized the city staff to begin formal discussions with these developers to figure out if they can reach an agreement, and the full council will vote October 22nd to give the full imprimatur, for lack of a better term. So we're still months away, Mike, from an agreement, and then we're years away from having anything completed.
Because this is a consortium of firms led by Crosland Southeast and the architecture firm, local architecture firm, Odell. They envision apartments to remind people, apartments, offices, hotels, restaurants, entertainment-oriented shops on the site. One of the developers, David Lefevre, is that how you say his name, says that the project must be financially successful, which is why they want the city to help in order to make this happen. Tim Sidema, managing partner with Crosland Southeast, agrees, but with a caveat.
Before we can even talk about what kind of public investment dollars might be required in order to move forward with the redevelopment, we have to do our job first to see what the private sector can underwrite and pay for on its own. My sense today is it will have to include a public-private partnership with additional public investment dollars.
So taxpayers will be asked to contribute.
Oh, there's no doubt. Yeah. There is no doubt. And Mike, the question, of course, is, so what's the bill going to be?
That was my question. Yes. How much?
How much? Well, I'm glad you asked, Mike, because we don't know.
But Luana Mayfield has definitely said she believes the city does not need to fork up too much more money because they've already invested millions to buy the said land, to clear the land, to try many attempts to redo something on the land, but they have failed. So she says they've done a lot.
Why would they need city help to make this work? This is a big piece of property sitting out there and everywhere else, like South End. Did they get help in South End to develop that before it was what it is today?
Well, I think with the private sector, what they're going to say, what they are saying is, look, it's been sitting there empty for a reason because it's not attractive. If it was, somebody would have gone and built something on it. So you can't make it work unless you have public subsidy.
But wait, South End wasn't attractive. People who were not here in 1985 don't remember what a horror that was.
Right,
right. There.
I wasn't alive in 1985, so I really can't tell you at all.
One key difference here, Mike. One key difference is that the city is also a little bit at the mercy of the private sector because they own the land. So they can't, if it's somebody else privately owns it, they can let it languish, but they own it and they feel very responsible and compelled to do something that will get that neighborhood.
Tax revenue.
Yeah, not only tax revenue, but get that neighborhood re-energized.
Okay, CMPD reported this week that violent crime in Charlotte is down this year, but that aggravated assaults and vehicle thefts are up. The good news is that we've had 44 homicides this year as opposed to 65 at this time last year. Do they understand why these things are moving in opposite directions, Alex?
I think year-to-year crime changes are not enough to make an informed analysis. All the experts, all the criminologists, academics you hear that talk about crime trends, it has to be more than 1 year, year-to-year, because things change, and it can just be an anomaly. So I don't think this says anything larger than this year if things are better.
Okay. And then weren't burglaries and car thefts up?
They were up.
Yes.
But it's also people were breaking into cars that were already unlocked. So the PSA for today, please lock your cars. Yes. That's basically what CMPD is saying.
Oh, we have a straight PSA.
Yeah. Well, CMPD Chief Kurt Putney has said he's not going to tell anybody what he's spending the $50 million coming from the federal government for, equipment and supplies for the Republican National Convention. He's not going to tell what he's spending the money on prior to the convention. Why does he want to keep that information so close to the vest?
CMPD says that is for security reasons, because they don't want to essentially hand out the playbook of what they're going to use to everyone ahead of time. And they did this several years ago for the DNC in 2012.
They didn't reveal how they were spending
it. Correct. They revealed it after the fact. And I know I got that list. I requested that list because I talked to Robert Dawkins with Safe Coalition NC. I know they're the ones pushing for CMPD to release what they will buy because they feel like it's their right to know as individuals in the city. They want to know what is coming. What are you guys buying that could be used against folks here, not just for the RNC, but for years to come? Because if CMPD stays within that $50 million limit, if the chief can justify using this equipment beyond the RNC, he can keep it. So that's why activists say they want to know, well, what are you buying? Because you might use this beyond that 1 week of the RNC.
Have we kept most of the DNC stuff?
To my knowledge, yes.
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 So that argument has a lot of merit.
Exactly. And a lot of that stuff I think we saw during the 2016 protests. I don't want to say one day was riots, but most of it was protests. But you saw a lot of riot gear. You saw the different bike motions and whatnot. All that stuff came from things they had purchased during the 2012 DNC.
We know that the CIAA tournament has been shopping for a new home. I don't know that we know the outcome of what their decision is yet. But at the same time now, the Queen City Battle of the Bands is leaving for Houston. First of all, Glenn, what is the Battle of the Bands and why is it significant?
Well, it was an annual event, or is an annual event, that brought marching bands from HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities, from all over to Charlotte to compete. And they competed at Memorial Stadium. And this thing grew from something fairly small to every year selling out Memorial Stadium.
The problem here, because we only have 30 seconds, the problem here is that they wanted a larger venue, and they say the city was not helpful. Why not?
I don't know. We've not been able to get anyone to talk about that. What they wanted was Bank of America Stadium, and they didn't get it. The Panthers have not responded so far. We've not been able to get anyone.
Were they talking to the old regime or the new regime?
I'm not positive about that.
What does this say about Charlotte being welcoming to more diversity?
Well, I think that's the sub-story there. This does not have the economic impact of the CIAA,
right. But
it does point to, as you said, what is the city doing to make this a more culturally diverse and economically diverse city? This is something that the city should have gotten behind and fostered and figured out how to grow.
That's Glenn Berkins. You get the last word, editor-publisher of QCityMetro.com. Eric Spanberg was here, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal. Kirsten Garris, government reporter for Spectrum News, and Alex Olgan, reporter for WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.